Good afternoon, everyone. The idea of this class for today, I don't know if you've ever experienced this. Has anyone ever encountered a text in the Torah that they find challenging? Not challenging like difficult to learn, but challenging like, whoa, like what do I do with this piece of Torah? It's like, yeah, it happens. There's a few of those in the Torah. And so the question is, what do we do when we encounter those challenging or difficult things in the Torah? What are we supposed to do with them as leaders in our community, as teachers, as learners who are learning that? What is there meaning to make of them, and if so, in what way? And we are going to look to the rabbis and how they engage with a particular set of texts around Ben Soror Umoreh, the rebellious and wayward son. And from the way the rabbis engage with this text, we're going to see if they can offer us any strategies for how we in our own lives can engage with difficult and challenging texts. So that is our mission for today. So before we get started looking at the text, I want to look at a couple of quotes with you and just get your thoughts on them. So Plato, famous quote of Plato's, is the pious loved by the gods because it is pious, or is it pious because it is loved by the gods? Meaning, do the gods love something? Do they say it's good because it is pious? Or is the very fact that the gods say something is pious, is that what makes it pious? Here's a restatement of that by Leibniz that I really like, a 17th century German philosopher. It is generally agreed that whatever God wills is good and just. Let me read that again. It's generally agreed that whatever God wills is good and just. But there remains the question whether it is good and just because God wills it, or whether God wills it because it is good and just. Which is to say, the mitzvot that we are commanded to do in the Torah, are they good and just? All of the mitzvot, all of the things that the Torah says to do, is it all good and just by nature of the fact that God tells us to do it? Or is the fact that God tells us to do it, that's what makes them good and just? They're not inherently good and just. God actually, the very fact that we're being commanded, that's what makes them good and just. In other words, whether justice and goodness are arbitrary, the mere fact that God says that we should do them, it's arbitrary. God could have said we should do other things. That the fact that they are good and just is arbitrary and God just tells us to do it, or whether they belong to the necessary and eternal truths about the nature of things. The things in the Torah themselves, they are intrinsically, there is something eternal about the goodness. It's just that God is also telling us to do them. But even perhaps without God, we could have arrived at those same truths without God. Does anyone have any thoughts, responses, or questions in response to hearing these two texts together? Yeah, Stephen.
So one of these positions assumes that there is something besides God in the world, and God actually has to pay attention to that in order to for his judgments to be just and good, which seems like a an improper limitation on God's being.
Meaning, can you say more about that? Which of these positions assumes that God, there's some outer thing that God has to pay attention to?
Goodness and justice is independent of God. There's a mm-hmm. there's a Platonic notion of an ideal of good and justice. Mm-hmm. And then God is adopting that. Then God mm-hmm. is not in control of that. He's reaching out into the world to take something and make it his own. That doesn't sound like a Jewish position to me.
That if there is an objective goodness and justice.
Separate from God.
Right. And God is simply saying, oh great, I have identified this eternal truth and now I'm going to put it
somebody
to you
else,
in command form.
Somebody else created it.
Or no one created it. It just existed as an eternal truth. Great. Okay, good. So there's a challenge there. Yeah.
I feel like maybe I'm going too far afield from what your question was, but I feel like there's already categories being made, right? There are things that God says do, whether they bris, keeping kosher for that matter. I mean, right? That God says, do these things, and therefore those are things that we do, and that somehow fall into this category of good things to do. But then there are things like, don't murder, and you should be nice to the people around you, that my friends who are atheists would say, I could get to that by myself, I don't need God to tell me that.
Great. So you're saying you're sort of now on the chukim and mishpatim situation. Yeah. That we have actually all sorts of different types of laws. We can't, this suggests that we can collapse it all into one category, but actually some laws, maybe there are some sort of eternal truths that we could have independently arrived at, and other laws, like no one would have gotten there had God not decided it was good and just and willed it to us.
Right.
Okay, great, yeah.
Is it also necessarily true that because God wills it, it's good and just?
Yeah, that feels like that's a, I mean, I don't know if this is, feels like this is maybe contextual in this time period, but the very first sentence that I've read twice for a reason is generally agree that whatever God wills is good and just. You're suggesting, do we even all agree with that statement?
And right, and you don't have to go to that it's unjust. It just may not be.
Could it be neutral?
Right.
Could be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does anyone else want to respond to that? I mean, of course, the follow-up, and this is how this leads into this shir, is that for the things in the Torah that they do not strike us, that they are commanded by God, and they do not strike us as particularly good or just, what do we do with that? Do we hold this assumption, well, it's in the Torah, so it must be good and just, and we just have to get ourselves behind it or figure out what was going on with the original intention? Or do we actually challenge this assumption and say, no, maybe not everything that is commanded is good and just? And if that's the case, well, then what do we do? Yeah.
But don't some people read it that way? That anything that's in there has to be that, and they have to force an explanation? And I feel I'm allowed to say that some things are not.
Great, and so perfect. And so you're saying, don't some people read as like, no, it has to be good and just, and then therefore they're forced to do some sort of work to arrive at that? And you're saying, I don't actually hold that assumption. Okay, I'm going to take the last comment, and then we're going to look at some Torah together. Yeah.
So I'm thinking of Saddam, where Abraham says, shall not the judge of the world do justice? And so he is saying, God's plan is not just. You know, he's saying there is something about what you want to do, and there's an idea of justice in the world, and it's different from what you want to do.
Right, which is to say, right, so I guess I want to respond to that in two ways. Maybe there are two ways of understanding that. One is that the thing that God initially willed and wanted to do was unjust all along, and we actually see Abraham reflecting that back, and God realizing like, oh, maybe, I mean, in the end, God still destroys. But reflecting, I mean, let's say daughters of Tzlochad, there was, right, the property laws they weren't going to inherit, that there's actually a system that all along was unjust. It's reflected back, and God is like, you're right, new system, let me impose something more justice. So that reveals that it was actually unjust. Or maybe B, there's actually some sort of like evolving sense of justice, that at the moment it was commanded, maybe it was just, and then something else, and then justice, our understanding of justice changed. And God made that sort of adjustment. But yeah, I think you're right to know that even within the Torah, you see sort of like a course correction of things being commanded and there are adjustments being made, which allows you to ask the question, what was wrong with the original thing? Was the original thing unjust that we made the correction in the first place? Okay, great to raise that. So we're going to be diving into the rebellious son. And our approach is going to be going back to the Torah as far as we can go, and then moving through time to see how the later rabbis and commentators deal with and wrestle with the text. What do they do when they encounter something that perhaps they feel is difficult, perhaps they don't feel as difficult? What are their strategies, and what does that mean for us? So you have your source sheet in front of you. We're going to read together from Devarim. And what I'm going to ask you to do, we'll read it all together, and then I'm going to ask you to generate all of the questions that this text brings up for you, all of the questions and all of the issues. Okay? Here we are. Ki yeh le'ish ben soror u'moreh. When there is to a man, I'll just translate, soror u'moreh is sort of hard to translate, but I'll translate it here as they translate it, as wayward and defiant. Einenu shomea b'kol aviv u'b'kol emo, and he doesn't listen to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother. Vayisru oto, and they punish him. Ve'lo yishma aleihem, and he doesn't listen to them, or he doesn't obey them. V'tafsu bo aviv v'imo, his mother and father should grab him. V'hotziu oto el ziknei iro, and they should bring him to the elders of the city. Ve'el shar mikomo, and to the gate of his place. The Amru El Ziknei Iro, and they should say to the elders of the city, Benenu Zeh Sora Umore, this son of ours is wayward and defiant. Einenu Shomea Bekolenu, he doesn't listen to our voices. Zolel Visovea. Again, these are also difficult words to translate. We don't see them in a lot of places. A glutton and a drunkard. Urgamuhu Kol Anshe Iroba Avenim, they should stone him, all the people of his city, with stones. The mate, and he will die. Uvi arta hara mikirbecha, and you should burn out this evil from your midst. The kol Yisrael yishmeu veyirau, and all of Israel should hear, and they will see. Okay, this is the fun part. Tell me all of the questions that this text raises for you. All sorts of different questions. Yeah.
For me, it's very strange that because your son or daughter doesn't listen to you, doesn't obey you, you kill them. There's no forgiveness. There's no, why is there no forgiveness? Why is there no leniency?
Great. So I'm going to suggest that you're raising two things. One is, and this is super appropriate for the learning we're doing this week, is where is the system of tshuva and forgiveness we've heard so much about? This doesn't seem to allow for any tshuva. That seems to be a problem. Right, I thought that the Jewish tradition really cared about tshuva, cared about forgiveness. Where is that in the story? The other is, I think you're suggesting that it seems like there's a disproportionate punishment to whatever this kid did. He didn't listen, he was disobedient, and so we kill him. So there's a disproportionate punishment. Okay, great. Other questions? Proportionate.
Why is it that the... obviously. Why is it that the parents are not being held accountable in some way for the behavior of their child? Like, how old is this child, and at what point are the behaviors the child's alone and not reflective of the parents?
Great. So you're wondering about the parents' role and responsibility? And you also asked a question about...
And I'm thinking about the shame also that the parents are facing and bring. So the parents are chastened, right, because they're bringing this child that they can't keep under control out into the public. So the whole community knows that there's a mismatch between the parents and the children somehow.
Say more about that last part, about the public nature of it.
Disciplining has a lot to do with personalities.
Uh-huh.
I'm a teacher, so I've raised hundreds of kids, you know.
Yeah.
I've seen hundreds of kids.
Yeah.
And some people are really good parents for this child, but not that child.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So here's parents who are not doing a good job with this child. Or the match between the disposition of the child and these parents is not a good match.
Great.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the parents are being chastened. They're being shamed by bringing this child out into the community, saying, we can't do anything with him. That's like a failing on the parent's part on some level.
Uh-huh.
And certainly as a parent, you would feel that.
Uh-huh.
So they're kind of paying in that respect, like socially.
Uh-huh. But you want to see a different kind of accountability.
Yeah.
Great. And you also raised the question of age. How old is this kid? That's not clear.
Like a four-year-old not paying attention.
We know he's a ben or a more. We know he's a child of this man, but we don't know at what age.
Is he not R, or is he a
yeah.
Ben?
Okay. Yeah, Micah.
There's no implication here that you need witnesses. Normally, witnesses are required here. Relatives are doing it. They don't count, at least under traditional.
You want witnesses to the behavior.
Yes.
If we're going to stone him for this behavior, why aren't there any witnesses to corroborate that?
Yes.
Right? I thought we had an entire tractate that is really committed to having a judicial system with witnesses that you have to warn and you have to make sure that they know the seriousness and the drisha and chakira and were you really there and on what date and can I confirm? Are you sure you're not false witnesses? And here there are no false witnesses. I can just bring my kid to the town court and get him stoned.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. That seems fair. Okay, good. Yeah.
Kind of about the publicity aspect, I think it's interesting that this starts as like a private household matter, and then the punishment is a very public thing, in front of the whole community, and the last line where they're saying, "Sweet body, evil from your mess, and all Israel will hear and be afraid," it's like they're witnessing it, and so they're so afraid they, it's like they then wouldn't want to come forward with their own because they don't want this destiny to happen to them. They're going to be afraid and not want to have to kill their own kid.
So you actually think this ritual would like prevent people from doing it in the future? Because I wouldn't want to bring my kid forward to get stoned.
Maybe, or just keep it internal instead of bringing it out to the public.
So your question is on the public nature of the punishment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do we know whether that fear reflects back to people not wanting to misbehave so that their parents don't bring them out into the public sphere, or is this fear, as you seem to indicate, on the part of the parents not wanting to bring out their recalcitrant, you know, right, children to be put in that position?
Right.
Where you sweep out evil.
No, in both cases you hide it.
No.
So there's a question about, do parents, this seems to be prescriptive, this is what parents should do, who are the parents that are actually participating in this? Is this what parents actually are wanting to do? Okay, yeah. Great, yeah. Tali.
Okay, I was wondering, is this meant to be read as a law or an observation of how like society works?
Is it prescriptive or descriptive? Is it describing this is what's happening, this is how we discipline our kids, or is prescriptive this is what you should do? Great, I'm not going to answer the question. Right now we're just asking questions, but it's a good question. Okay, someone else can yell out.
Is the death penalty appropriate?
Is the death penalty appropriate? Yeah. So that feels like that's going back to the disproportionate punishment question. Right, I would ask another question. Is the death penalty appropriate? Appropriate for what? What did he do? What was the crime? Yeah, Avi.
That was what I wanted to touch on. Yeah. It's a little actually unclear here what the kid or the son has done, because it begins by saying he's wayward and defiant, which is sort of a whole host of behaviors associated with all kinds of other behaviors that could happen. But there's this part where they say, the son of ours is disloyal and defiant, he does not heed us, that seems fine. Then they tack on this line about he is a glutton and a drunkard, which in itself is certainly something that a parent might rebuke their child about, but certainly like not necessary, there's plenty of other things they might do. And so it's not clear whether they're trying to suggest that at the heart of all this is about gluttony and drinking, or you need to say that because that gets it to a certain level for some reason, or how important that aspect of it is compared to, or if that's just sort of them just kind of gilding the lily a little bit.
Is that a stand-in, or is it actually gluttony and drunkardness that we're talking about, or is that just kind of a stand-in for the degree?
Right.
Great. Lots of questions there. Is it that he's eneno shomea? He's not responsible to discipline? Is the gluttony, gluttony and drunkenness, is that the problem? Is it standing up for something else? In this line that it says, beneno zeh soreo more, right? He's wayward and defiant. Eneno shomea doesn't listen to kolenu. Zolel v'sovea. Like, what is the, is it that, is he all three things? Does he not listen and he's a glutton and he's a drunkard? Or is somehow the glutton and the drunkard falling under the category of not listening? Very confusing. Yeah.
For me, this thing seems to imply that it will be a deterrent for other children to misbehave and not obey their parents because this kid was stoned with the death penalty. I question whether or not that is really true. I mean, will it actually act as a deterrent?
So you're about the effectiveness of this. You don't think this would be effective?
I don't think so.
But I actually think that if you read it as prescriptive, like this is what parents should do, it says they shall do this if all these other things happen, I just think the fear that's being induced is telling the parents, you need to do a better job disciplining. The problem with kids is it affects the whole community if they're not good, and we expect you to do such a good job disciplining so that you're not forced to go through this whole process and your son gets stoned for it.
Great. Okay, let's do two more final comments and then we're going to move on. Yeah.
I guess I'm wondering, like, is this the first time that the child has been wayward and defiant? Or is this, like, it sounds like it's a pattern where he's disloyal, he's defiant. Like, what has been this, like, the breaking point where you're like, okay, we decided you're defiant, we're going to stop.
Amazing. What gets us up to, and you could ask that either on the glutton or drunken, if that's the issue, or on the way we're defiant. At what point have I like triggered it such that I'm suddenly in this world? How long has this gone on? What are the actions? Yeah, that seems hugely important. do I just wake up, I'm a good kid, and then the next day I'm wayward and defiant, and then I'm in this category? Or does there have to be some like ongoing repeated behavior for a certain amount of time? Okay, great. Yeah, David.
So what if we turned it around? And the comment about witnesses, I think, really brings this to the fore, because this is not a judicial process.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually a resource or a utility for the parents
mm-hmm.
who have given up.
Uh-huh.
Nobody has to, no one is adjudicating whether the child is, in fact, of this matter, behaves in this manner. The declaration feels like a ritualistic declaration.
Mm-hmm.
And so really it says, if you really can't take care of your kid, here's what's, you don't have social workers available to you or guidance counselors or clever teachers, but what you have is you have a public process where you bring the child to the court and the court executes him on your behalf. Which is important to think about for just one reason.
Yeah.
That until very recently in Western society, corporal punishment by parents was permissible. And so certainly at this time it was permissible. So if you want to talk about the straight and the good, what this does is it takes the issue of a family out of the family setting into a more public setting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Is there a question that I should translate that?
No, sorry.
A really astute comment. Okay, good. Okay, good. I'll take astute comments also. Okay.
All right, you wanted the question. Is it a judicial process or not? It's not a judicial
process. Is this a judicial process or not?
Yeah.
Right. That's a good question.
Sorry.
And a good comment. Right. And again, this sort of goes back to the witness question. It goes back to what exactly, how long has this been going on? I think it goes back to even like, what is the role of Zikney Yero? Why do we suddenly bring it out to the elders of the city? Who are these elders of the city? Are they acting judicial? Is there some sort of like, are they some sort of like Beit Din or court? Or are they just like the elders? What is their function there? Okay. These are some questions that we've generated on the text from the Torah. I think that the rabbis also had some questions about this text as well. So what I'm going to have you do now is in Chavruta, I want you to spend some time together, a good amount of time, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes together or something. We're going to turn to the Mishnah. So the Mishnah being the earliest, you have the Torah. I'll just give you one sentence description. You have the Torah, which is the five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. You have the Mishnah written from 0 to 200 CE. You have this on your source sheet, I think, which is the earliest rabbi's first attempt to make a legal code. So those rabbis were like, well, there was some stuff in the Torah. Now we have to figure out how to put it into practice. What do we do with this? So we're going to be looking at the Mishnah, which is going to be how does the Mishnah deal with putting the laws around Ben Sora or Moreh into practice? How does it understand it? From the Mishnah, we're then going to be going on to the Talmud, which is the next generation, the later rabbis wrestling with the Mishnah. So the Talmud, I'm talking about 200 to 500 CE. And the Mishnah made all sorts of assumptions and shorthands, and they knew what each other were talking about. Already when you get to the next generation, you get to 200 CE, 300 CE, those rabbis didn't necessarily understand the Mishnah. And so when we talked about this in the davening class, in the Minyan this morning, but when the rabbi said, from what time can I say Shema from this amount of time? And then the rabbis of the next generation of the Gemara, they were already like, well, exactly, what did you mean by Shema? And what did you mean by first light? And so we're going to follow this through time and see, the Torah tells us what to do with the wayward son. We're supposed to stone him. And then the rabbis of the Mishnah are like, but how do we actually put this into practice? What is the law around it? Is there some sort of witnessing? How old is he? What does it mean to be wayward? And then we're going to see how the later rabbis of the Talmud deal with the Mishnah, and then we're going to go forward even from there until eventually we get to where we are today of what do we do with difficult text. So in your Chavrutas 2, 3 is totally up to you, I don't feel strongly. Spend some time with the Mishnah. You're looking at Tractate Sanhedrin. Interesting, right? Tractate Sanhedrin, that's all about the judicial system and the courts. So we had David saying this isn't judicial. And of course, Ben Sora Morer is being located in the tractate that's dealing with the courts, because like, what exactly is going on here? Is this a judicial process or is it not a judicial process? So spend some time with it. And you're going to start on page 2, and you're going to go through the midway through page 4. So stop when it says the Gemara. don't continue with the Gemara, just stay with the Mishnah. And I specifically, you have some guiding questions at the top of it, step two, the Mishnah. I specifically, what I want you to be looking for is what are the questions that the rabbis of the Mishnah are concerned with, and how do they answer them? I had you generate your own list of questions. What are the questions that the rabbis of the Mishnah are concerned with? How do they answer them? And then the third question is, why do they answer them as they do? Is there some sort of agenda? What are their questions? How do they answer them? And what is their agenda? Why do they answer them that way? Okay? So take some good amount of time together, 20 minutes, maybe a little bit more, and I'll come around and check. Feel free if you want to stay in here, if you want to like find space out in the halls, I'll be around. Okay, I know you guys are still doing some learning, and that's a really good thing. I'm going to pause your learning and bring your learning all together. Some of you didn't see all of it, that's totally fine. Some of you did, that's totally fine. We'll do this together. I think you saw enough of it. So tell me, I want to hear you report back. Based on your learning, what questions were the rabbis concerned with? Were they concerned with any of our questions? How did they answer them? And overall, what did you see? What were the rabbis doing? So anyone can start answering and point to when you're saying they were concerned with this question and this was their answer. Show me where in the text you see that happening. That'll be our way that we get into the text. Yeah, Tali.
So one of the questions we saw was how old is the child?
That was basic. Great. We said, Ben. What is the Ben? And the rabbis give us a very specific answer. What is their answer? Roughly.
Starts with two hairs.
Right, and there's a lower beard and an upper beard. Let's be clear what that is. The lower beard and the upper beard. Right, so it has to be in a very specific state of puberty that his pubic hair has started to come in, but he doesn't yet have a beard. Right, so we've narrowed the range of what could Ben have been. Could have meant all sorts of things. Could have meant I'm always my father's son up until any sort of age, like even when I'm 25 or 30. It could be a five-year-old. And now we've said, actually, it's this very specific narrow window of when, basically, I'm in puberty. And then if I go outside of that window, I'm already outside of the window of Ben.
Mm-hmm. Wait, is there an upper limit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, it is an upper limit.
From when he grows two hairs until the beard grows full.
So the I see.
Or when he's off your cell phone plan.
Which is basically always a Ben forever. No, I have friends still on their parents' family plans. They're lucky. Okay, other people, other questions you see that the rabbis are concerned with, and how do they answer them? Yeah.
What does it take to be a glutton and a Ben Sober Mora, and the gluttony and the drunkardness? And it seems like they list all these various things that this individual could do, eating the first time, eating the second time, and eating treif and everything else. But it's not until he eats meat and wine that it counts as being a glutton and a drunkard.
Great. So we're both setting limits, and we're also eliminating all sorts of types of categories of food, instances in which he's eating, in which even if he was being a glutton in those contexts, if they were like mitzvah purposes or if they were treif food, that also gets him kicked out of the category. Yeah.
Yeah. So that part threw me for a while. So if he ate whatever the amount of meat is and wine, if it's kosher meat, then he's rebellious and, you know, subject to this punishment.
Uh-huh.
But if it's treif, then he's not rebellious.
So
he's not
subject
to the punishment.
Because you feel like Dafka, if he's eating a lot of treif food and a lot of treif wine, all the more so he's rebellious.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
It seems very strange. Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to make sure that was right.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Does anyone have a thought about what's happening?
Well, we were talking about whether it was intentional or unintentional. So, for example, if you eat an animal that was not slaughtered properly, it may not be intentional that you ate that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, being a glutton, eating meat, and being a drunkard, drinking too much wine to excess, that's almost an intentional thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I I think that part of what's going on is we're like, well, we see that the Torah wants us to punish him if he's eating too much and drinking too much. So there's something about food going on, but let's eliminate all sorts of categories. We can't cut rid of food all out entirely because the Torah says that we have to do this. So let's eliminate all sorts of different categories of food. So like food that's eaten, if he gets too drunk at Passover, that's okay. It's a ritual Seder, right? If he's eating trait food, that's not really food anyway, right? Like that's not Jewish food. That's not really food. So that's also not going to trigger it. So we're eliminating all sorts of different categories of food ultimately to narrow what counts as food that he would be chayav for.
Because the rabbis want to make this very, very difficult because they don't want to go stoning a kid, right? So they're trying to make it really hard for someone to land in this category. They narrow the age really, really a lot, and they narrow the conditions under which you could call it drunkenness and gluttony.
I would think you'd be narrowing it. I agree. I would have thought that you'd be narrowing it more if you said only if it's trade. And it would be more consistent. Like, in that, I mean, I don't know, in that culture, and this goes to the point that you were making in our discussion, I would think it would be very, it would be harder to eat trade than it would be to eat, if you're talking about the same amount of food, but then you were making the point about emulating the non, you know, the Romans. I thought maybe got to it.
Saying what? Meaning what? Just say
I was wondering if, like, what their concern here really is about, like, the son who goes out and is engaging in sort of, like, a Roman-style feasting.
Uh-huh.
He's sort of, like, part of the issue or the concern here is, like, the fact that he's, like, this is not something that we do, like, eat and meat and drink like this, but you were probably at some sort of Roman symposium or something.
Yeah.
And engaging in kind of Goyish practices, and that's part of the waywardness and the rebelliousness beyond just eating and drinking too much.
Interesting. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I acknowledge. Okay, other questions you see being addressed here? I think this question of the role of the parents, the responsibility, like what was the home this kid came from? Well, I think there's a few different things. So one, I think the role of the parents, responsibility, the home. I think we see that happening on page 3. Mm-hmm. The idea of if the father wants and the mother does not want, the father does not want and the mother wants, he does not become. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Im lo haita imo reuya le'aviv, eino na'ased ben tzar mo'er. If the mother is not fitting or appropriate for the father, he does not become a ben tzar mo'er, not become a wayward son.
What does that mean?
What does it mean? So certainly, like, going back to our list of questions, you want to be like, I have another question. What does it mean she's not fitting? That's a fair question. Does anyone want to take a guess at it? They're not a good parenting team, right? We already see that there's like a little bit going back to like, do parents want to participate in this ritual? Or are they trying to get a boy? Like, so you have a little bit of like, one of them wants to do the stoning thing, one of them doesn't want. It's not clear that they're on the same page with discipline. Maybe they're not a good parenting team. There's some sort of friction in the house. So someone was saying like, I don't know, what if he's coming from like a broken environment? What if the parents are actually really responsible? So there's a sense of maybe, I'm not saying this is the answer, but we can all postulate like the rabbis do. Maybe what it means for the mother not to be appropriate for the father is that actually they're not doing a good job parenting together. There's some sort of disciplining happening, and therefore it doesn't fall on the son. He doesn't become a ben tzar mo'er because in part the parents are responsible.
They just send it back. It's just not taken up by the court of the old elders. They just say, okay, this doesn't even fit for the court.
Right. The criteria have not been met. To trigger that. I'm not saying, I think I like John's reading. I'm not saying that's the only reading, but I think that this line is mysterious. What does it mean that the mother is not fitting to the father? And I think that that's one good idea there. Yeah.
I'm sorry to monopolize. It just occurred to me about the food part of it. Is that a defense? Is that a tool for the child to defend themselves against this? No, never mind, sorry. I'm just trying to think, like, there are, you know, God, it's awful, there are stories in the news all the time of parents that are doing terrible things to their kids. And so you think, well, no parent would do this, and having, you know, having have to be the mom and the dad agreeing to this is a shield, and it is a little bit, but still we see, you know, parents putting their children in danger, both parents putting their children in danger. And so I was just trying to think if there's something that the child could do to protect themselves, even if both parents are against the child.
Wow.
But it didn't work.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, we don't really hear much from the child in this story.
So I was a lawyer in a former life, and you know, we have precedent in American law, and you can't do anything. The Supreme Court says something, you can't do anything with the precedent, but you can distinguish it. You know, you can distinguish it and narrow it so to the point where there's nothing left of the original decision which you didn't like. And it just seems to me that you go through this whole paragraph, everything here is trying to distinguish it so it will never, so it will never come up.
Yeah. Okay, good.
And then there's also stuff in here, you know, you talked about proof texts. There's a lot of stuff in here where there is no proof text. And as a matter of fact, all this business about warning him in front of three, lashing him, judged by a court of 23, he gets a chance to run away. All of that, none of that shows up in the Torah.
I would challenge you there.
Well, not in the portion that we were.
Let's look at it a little bit, because so we're moving into a new charting, which is strategies for how we deal with difficult texts, strategies for how the rabbis, and I think that you've nailed it. Strategy number one, really narrow the application. This is not quite to say we are not doing this, we are crossing another Torah, but to say we're just going to narrow and narrow and narrow so that theoretically it could still be put into practice. We're just going to really narrow the possible application. So strategy number one is sort of narrowing the thing, maybe out of existence, but still maintaining the possibility. In terms of some of the examples you gave, you're right. I think some of it, it's not where does it get it in the Torah. Maybe like some of the stealing, I don't know. I think you could argue a lot of it, the proof text. Where I want to see the, they warn him in front of three and lash him. If he repeats his misdeeds, he is judged by a court of 23. Do you see, can you find any of that in the original text in Devarim? Like if I had to say, what is the proof text for that?
And bringing him to the elders is often a euphemism or a way of talking about the court.
Okay. So the elders are maybe standing in for he is brought in front of the court. Great. What about the warning him and the repeated behavior? Could you find that in the Devarim at all?
Well, just the wayward itself may mean that he's done this more than once.
That the wayward implies a repetitive behavior? Yeah, what about the language of Vayisru tove lo yishma aleihem? What is the... taught this class a couple times. What does the language of the Vayisru mean? That they disciplined him in some way and he didn't respond, which is to say, what did it mean he disciplined? He disciplined them. They had witnesses present. The witnesses saw it and then he did it again. So I both see to what you're saying that it feels like, where are they getting this stuff? They're not, it's not like totally out of air, but you do see the rabbis doing some pretty fancy footwork to connect this. All that amazing stuff about the father and the mother, and if there's any sort of disability there, if any of it, not blind, not seeing, not having arms, that's not, it's sort of crazy what they go off on, but it's located in the text, right? They're like, well, they have to grab them, they have to listen, they have to be able to see, they have to be able to point to my son, so obviously they have to be able to see. So it's both like, where are they getting it from? And also, they actually are still doing it within the, I would argue that they are still doing it within the framework of Torah, tenuously. They are working very hard to stay within the framework of Torah, even as they really narrow the application. And I think that that's a really important point. They don't just get rid of it. They're working hard within Midrash.
But do you want to distinguish between close reading and intention? Would you like to comment on that?
No, I want to understand your comment better.
It almost feels as if they are, by narrowing, as you said before, by narrowing, they're eliminating this possibility. Mm-hmm.
You're saying they're not really doing an honest, close reading. They have a clear agenda, which is to eliminate this possibility that they're imposing onto the text. It's not an honest, close reading.
They're being expansive in their reading.
Yes.
With an agenda.
I think that that's true. I agree with you there. Yes, Rabbi Alvin Comfort.
In terms of their agenda, that's something that always puzzled me. Usually in our liberal modern sense, we say the rabbis didn't like capital punishment, they wanted to read it out of the Torah by making it impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Is that their motivation? And then I read a little footnote by David Weiss Halivni that said, no, the rabbis would never oppose anything in the Torah. They just thought that a human court couldn't carry it out effectively.
We're going to come to that at the end.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's good. Come back to it. It's good. Okay, I want to move on. Talk to me about page 4. Ben Sor Umore Nidon Al Shem Sofo Yamut Zakai Al Yamut Chayav. A Ben Sor Umore should be judged by his final name. He should die innocent and not die guilty. How did you guys understand that? What does it mean that he should be judged by his Shem Sofo, the name of his end?
He should be judged by the way he's treated. So if he's executed, then it's really a judgment on the society and on the community, it seems like.
If his final end is execution, really it almost sounds like the society should be judged on that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
The idea seems to be pretty clearly, I think, that it's like that movie, you know, whatever
yes.
the movie is.
Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah, where he's going to end up, you're going to punish him now. Why are you going to punish him now? You're going to punish him now because he's innocent now, but he's going to be guilty in the end. You punish him now, so he'll die innocent, and that's good for him, and also it's good for society because he won't have done all these bad things. I mean, a very dangerous proposition, but nevertheless. They're sort of wondering. I think they're going to the disproportionate punishment issue. They're saying it's not really disproportionate because this is where you would have ended up killing a lot of people, and you're just dealing with that now.
Great. Okay. Good. So you've said a lot of great things. Thank you for teaching the class for me. It's good. So you're saying, what is Nidono Shem Sofo? It means that he's judged, he should be judged by his final end, where he would have gotten to. Okay, right now he's just a glutton and drunkard, but we all know what's next for this glutton and drunkard. He's going to be out there on the streets, robbing people, killing people. That's really going to be bad. Then when he dies, he's going to be like someone who's like committed murder and robbery. We don't want that to happen for him. That's not good for him. That's not good for us. Better to kill him now, since we know with certainty that's where he's going to end up. Okay, so that's strategy number 2. Strategy number 1 of confronting this difficult text is we narrow its application, maintain while staying in the framework of Torah, right? We honor Torah, but we narrow its application by making it basically impossible to put into practice, but we maintain the possibility and honor Torah in that way. Strategy number 2 of dealing specifically with this difficult text is we say, what's difficult about this text? The disproportionate response. Where did the death penalty come from? What is he even being punished for? What's challenging to us is that it feels like it's crazy that this rebellious son suddenly gets stoned, okay? Publicly. That's the challenge. How do we make that better? How do we deal with that difficulty? We say, oh, he's not being stoned for this glutton and drunkard being a little bit disobedient. It's really this thing he's going to do. What are the pros and cons of this particular strategy of dealing with this difficult text? The pro, Micah, you said, is that now we no longer have a problem with a disproportionate response. It's not a disproportionate response. It's an appropriate response given the fact that he's going to become a murderer, right? Other pros and cons with this particular strategy? Yeah.
Even though the majority of people may go to that end, it doesn't mean that he's going to end up being a murderer and robbing and stealing and things like that.
That's a con. Do we really know that for a certain day? Like, are we really so sure that's his end? That's a big leap to make. Okay, yeah. Yes, Robin.
It assumes that, like, even if he does go in that direction, that tshuva wouldn't be possible.
What happened to tshuva? I thought, yeah, that seems like a major con. So on one hand, this strategy of Nidon Al Shem Sofo answers a major difficulty in the text, which is the disproportionate response to the fact that we're killing him. But it creates a really huge other problem, which is like, first of all, do we really believe that a person's fate is totally determined and they can't change their behavior? Do we know for certainly? And second of all, like, what about tshuva? I thought we really cared about tshuva. Nidono shem sefo eliminates the possibility for tshuva in this framework. It solves one problem and creates another problem. Yes?
It also seems to be, or at least the way it's articulated here, introducing a sense of vindictiveness. It's we're judging him by the end, and if we were to wait until the end and then punish him, that would actually be better for him, because it's a good thing for the wicked to be
killed. Get copper on his death. Uh-huh.
Right, so by killing him now, it's actually more of a punishment.
But we are killing him now so he doesn't ever do the sin for which he would need the atonement for.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's doubly, though, because
yeah.
Assuming that he's going to do that, and assuming that he does end up there, it's better to kill him. It's even more of a punishment to kill him before he's done any of that stuff, because afterwards, he won't mind.
Well, I don't agree with that.
That's not what it's saying.
I don't think. I think it's saying this is better for him to die now.
Right.
When he's innocent, it's better for him to die now. It would be worse for him if we let him go and kill people and then you kill him, because then he's a really bad guy. Here he's being killed innocently. So I mean, that could have been an argument, but I don't think that's what they made.
Well, so what I take from it, and I don't know the Hebrew, so I could be completely off, but because the death of the wicked is beneficial to them and beneficial to the world.
Then let's do it. That's what it's saying. Let's go ahead and do it. It's beneficial to them, so let's do it.
Yeah. I think that the point is that it's true he's not getting, the death could have been his atonement, but better that you kill him now before he needs atoning in that way. Then let him do the sin, and then, okay, he could have gotten death in his atonement, but why don't we just short-circuit that so he never gets that? Okay, I want to move on to another strategy. So Mishnah says a lot of stuff. We're going to jump to the Gemara. I want you to turn to page 5 with me. Really amazing. What does it mean? The Gemara is commenting on trying to understand this line. So I'm on the first paragraph there. What does it mean when Rabbi Yehuda says that the mother has to be re'uya, appropriate for the father? I'll read this in the English. We have another teaching in which Rabbi Yehuda says, if his mother was not identical to his father, I'm on page 5. If his mother was not identical to his father in voice, appearance, and height, he does not become a stubborn and rebellious son. Right, what does it mean to be re'uya? They have to be identical in voice, appearance, and height. Why is this the reason? How do we, right, going back to what's the proof text? There's always a proof text. How do we prove it? Because he does not obey enenu shomea kolenu, our voice. What does our voice teaches? It teaches that they have to have the same voice. And since we're already requiring that they be identical in voice, they also must be identical in appearance and height. Okay, so you have the Mishnah saying, really putting this interesting and strange limitation, she has to be fitting, right? That's already a narrowing. And then you have the Gemara, this Baraita, Rabbi Yehuda, it takes it so much further and says, not only does she have to be fitting, not only it could have been that we just said, okay, fine, Kolenu, we'll go with you there. She has to be identical in voice. What, you know, man, woman are identical in voice, but now it has to be voice, height, and appearance. So you really see, again, as far as this strategy, this really intense narrowing of application. I want to go on a little bit with your permission. And so now the Gemara is going to say, I'm just going on in the reading. Keman Azla, who does this follow? Ha detanya ben sorer umore. Lo haya velo atid liyot. Velama nichtav drosh vekabel schar. We have this teaching. We have a baraita, something from the same period of the Mishnah, that says, ben tzurar moreh never was and never will be. And why do we have it in the Torah? Drosh vekabel schar. So we could learn, and through the learning, we can receive merit. Who does that follow? Who is that? Who is like the author of the teaching, or whose opinion is that like? Kiman, it's like none other than Rabbi Yehuda. Why is it like Rabbi Yehuda? because they basically narrowed it out of existence, right? Rabbi Yehuda basically narrowed it out of existence, and so therefore it follows that it never was and never will be because we've made it practically impossible. So you could collapse this next strategy into narrowing. I'm going to say it's actually taking this a step further. I think narrowing, it's staying within the framework of Torah and our tools of Midrash. We're trying to stick it to our proof text. We're still allowing for the possibility of keeping it on the books. I think strategy number three of Drosh ve'kabel schar is really saying, like, we are not allowing for any possibility that this was never meant to put into practice. This never was, never will be. This is purely sort of an educational exercise through which we gain merit. Talk to me about the pros and cons of this strategy for dealing with a difficult text. What are the pros or what are the cons?
One pro is it disseminates the power from being just the text or like an authority figure being redeemed the number one authority on the Torah to say how we need to operate. Basically says, once you're capable of doing these strategies, you can question authority effectively. Anyone can do it.
Okay, so great. So it allows us to question authority. You're saying that as a pro?
Even better. I don't know, maybe it's
not. Yeah.
It sets precedent for other cases.
In a good way?
In a good way, I think so. It's not saying that just anyone can do it, but it gives permission for our voices to be, certain voices to be added and can change things.
Great. You guys are on the same team? Yeah.
I think the con of it is that we might say, like, they're not dealing honestly with the test, with the text. They're not, it allows them to get out of the whole struggle of it. And if they just say, well, actually, this is really just to sort of teach us some other lessons, then you've got a really handy tool there to just throw that around anytime you want and disregard any part of Torah that you don't like.
Right. So I'm going to say that that's actually two separate cons. One is, I think what you're saying is it's not dealing dishonestly, it's dishonest with the text. I think this goes back to what you were saying, that, but the Torah says to do it, right? Like, to deal honestly with the text is to deal with the fact that, like, it literally says to do it. What do you mean we're not supposed to do this? It's in the Torah. Is that, so it feels like there's a dishonesty there to say, oh no, the Torah never meant that. God clearly never meant that. And the second is, what are the limits? On one hand, you're saying as a pro, it's setting precedent, it's bringing new voices. The limit is like, so can I get rid of anything I don't like in the Torah? Like, sota, like, what else can I apply this ritual? What else can I apply this this reading? I'm just saying, no, it was just meant to be studied. The Torah, God never meant that piece of the Torah. And going back to, who gets to decide that? So on one hand, this strategy, Drosh ve'kabel schar, solves a lot of problems, which is to say, the part of the Torah that you thought was really difficult, it is difficult, and it was never meant to be put into practice. You're supposed to, the conversations we're having here today, that's what was intended, that we should really take a hard look and study and learn. That's what the Torah meant. It solves those difficult parts. It creates another problem, which is to say, is that really honest? Where are the limits? Where does it start? It creates a whole other set of problems. Okay, I want to push on a little bit more. So Rabbi Yehuda, or sort of this Baraita that's saying, we're not sure if this is really Rabbi Yehuda. We're saying, who is it like? Maybe it's Rabbi Yehuda. But we have this opinion in the Baraita that says, lo haya ve'lo atid liot, never was, never will be. Why was it written? Drosh ve'kabel schar, but not so fast. Jump down to the next paragraph. Then they think, actually, maybe it's Rabbi Shimon that authored this, lo haya ve'lo atid liot. Why? Because Rabbi Shimon also said something similar. Rabbi Shimon also challenged that, really, just because he ate this meat and drank this wine, we're going to stone him? No, rather, lo haya ve'lo atid liot. And then in response to this, we get an amazing response by Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Shimon says, lo haya ve'lo atid liot. The Lama Nichtav Drosh ve'kabel schar, it was written just so that we should learn, receive merit. Amar Rabbi Yonatan, this is the very last line on page 5. Amar Rabbi Yonatan, ani re'itiv ve'yashafti al kivro. I saw him. I saw the Ben Sora Merer, and I sat on his grave. Rabbi Yonatan digs his heels in. I'm going to say this is strategy 4. sat on his grave, which is to say, of course, we practice Bansura Morer. It's in the Torah, right? This is the strategy of the Torah says to do this. Do not narrow it out of existence. Do not claim it's Nidon Hashem Sofo. You invented that. It is not Drosh Vekabel Schar. It was never meant to be practiced. It's in the Torah. We're supposed to follow it. And I know that because I sat on his grave. I sat on the grave of the Bansura Morer. So number four, strategy number four is like, yeah, it's in the Torah, it's difficult, and we do it. I mean, maybe not even acknowledging the difficulty of just saying, like, it's in the Torah, it's just, we do it. Okay, thoughts about that? We're not done yet. Yeah, Avi.
I feel like this story is kind of like a cool story, bro, kind of thing, which is just like, really? Like, there's a sort of a tendency, another learning I've done, where, like, there'll be a dispute like this, and one of the rabbis will say, oh, actually, I happen to have seen this thing that no one else here has ever seen and talked about, but I did see it one time.
Uh-huh.
Which is sort of like, oh, you're just mentioning it now, huh?
Uh-huh.
You know, like,
cool story, bro.
Cool story, bro. Like, you know, but photos, or it didn't happen. You know?
Uh-huh.
Like, it sort of feels like he wants it to be true, but, like, it's kind of hard to imagine a circumstance where none of these other rabbis have heard the story that Rabbi Yonatan never came up before, and now all of a sudden he's telling them.
Yeah.
This person is kind of difficult to have a disagreement with because they're like, I saw it happen, I sat on the grave, and it disappeared from the page or whatever. So I wonder if it's just like a strategy, like you're showing us, like that's the strategy, I mean, that is a belief.
But you could feel like maybe the indignation of like he's pushed up against the wall of like all these creative readings of like, stop narrowing it. Stop stop saying it's about its final end. Stop saying Joshua Kabel Schar. No, it's in the Torah. We got to do it. It happened. End of story, right? Like, let's stop trying to work around. Okay, let's keep reading a little bit. I want you to look at page 7. This comes from the Beit Mordechai, Rabbi Mordechai Fogelman of the 19th century. And he's commenting on something that he's noticed about the Me'iri, a 13th century commentator. Okay? The practice of the Me'iri in his books, I should just warn you, this is my translation, so take it with a grain of salt. The practice of the Me'iri in his books is not to leave out a single thing, small or large, that is mentioned in the Gemara. He brings in the different opinions, establishes his position, explains, clarifies, and then makes a ruling. He gives you everything and then decides. In our sugya, he passes over in silence the words of the sages that with regards to the wayward son, the idolatrous city, and the leprous house, about all three of these things. You didn't get to see that today. About all three of these things, the sages say they never were and never will be. And why were they written? To interpret and receive merit. The Me'iri, what's the problem for the Beit Mordechai? The Me'iri doesn't leave out any opinions. He brings everything, and then he makes a ruling. But curiously, in our sugya, he very noticeably leaves out lo haya ve'lo atid liyot, a very famous thing, right? In his writings on Sanhedrin 71, the Me'iri briefly writes, the halakha is not according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says that they have to be fitting in all ways, and the law of the wayward son is executed even when the parents are not equal, and even when the mother is not appropriate for the father. And you also know that the law of the idolatrous city, you learn that, which they said, even if there's a single mezuzah, the city is saved. We don't kill, destroy the entire city. And the halakha doesn't follow that opinion. So the Me'iri does know, he says, this narrowing that Rabbi Yehuda wants to do, this is out. We definitely don't do this narrowing. We do, in fact, do Bansura Morer, but he doesn't even address the Drosh V'Kabel Schar. And the reason for this is it doesn't make sense that the wayward son, the idolatrous city, and the leprous house, positive and negative commandments, were not written in the Torah so that they would be observed and performed and executed. This is like a negative, right? Clearly, they were written in the Torah to be observed, performed, and executed, but only for the purpose of drosh v'kabel schar, interpret and receive merit, meaning to interpret and to examine in the name of interpretation alone, never with the purpose of executing them. And then he says, lo hamidrash huaykar ela ha. It's not the interpretation, your fun interpretive tradition, that's the essence. It's the ma'aseh. And what is the ma'aseh? What is the action of Ben Sora Morer? Stone him. Enough with all of your midrashim. Tens, even hundreds of times, the Torah commands us, especially in Devarim, in its beautiful language, with its emphasis and different expressions, the laws and rules of the Torah. meaning not to relate to them if they were as if they were symbolic commandments, purely educational, academic, and abstract. The sages, in fact, oppose this, as is known, symbolic interpretations and explanations of the commandments of the Torah, as is the way of those who are associated with Greek wisdom. Let the Greeks do their symbolic readings. We have laws, and we follow the laws literally. They were meant to be performed. They saw in this method a danger to the establishment and execution of the commandments of the Torah and her laws. Rather, in closing, it doesn't make sense to say the commandments of the Torah were never meant to be performed and never will be performed, and they were written only to interpret and receive merit. This is a slam down, right? This is, I sat on his grave. Enough with all of these strategies. If it says it in the Torah, it must be true. It must be just, and we have to follow it through. I want to read one more piece, and then we'll wrap up. Then you get, so that's very clear, right? According to the Beit Mordechai, and specifically his reading on the Meiri, is there's just no way. Ben Sor Maror, 100%. We put it into practice, okay? And then Rav David Shlomo Ishbitz comes along.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Before you go on. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Mordechai Fogelman wanted to shine such a bright light on this in the 19th century?
Like Dafka in that time period? That's a good question. Can we come back to that after class? Because I want to push on, but it's a good question. Okay, so check out this one. The Arve Nachal, what does he say? Therefore, it seems to me the opposite, meaning there what he's saying, the opposite that it shouldn't, that it should be put into practice. It's the opposite that it should be practiced. As it said in Sanhedrin, the wayward son never was and never will be, and it was only said to interpret and receive merit. So his first comment that you're getting out of context is he says, really, this is a case of drosh v'kabel schar. It's the opposite that we should be putting into practice. It's drosh v'kabel schar. But, right, regardless, this law doesn't fall under the courts of human jurisdiction. Because human courts refer to that which is handed to the lower Beit Din to judge, which isn't true in this case, which is only for the purpose of interpreting and receiving merit. This case is only about drosh v'kabel schar. Regardless, this law falls under the heavenly courts. Ben Sor Maror, the stoning, is not under human jurisdiction. It's under heavenly jurisdiction. In the heavenly courts, people are judged on future actions. In the heavenly courts, you can judge Nidon al Shem Sofo, for better or for worse, as in the case of the wayward son. But in human courts, one does not judge based on the final end in any circumstance. So he sort of offers two readings. One, he says, how do I deal with this difficult text? Really, it's drosh v'kabel schar. But if you don't like the answer, if you think that actually it says it in the Torah and we're supposed to put it into practice, fine. But when it's said in the Torah, it was never meant to be under human jurisdiction, right? He goes back to Nidon al Shem Sofo. For one, it's Nidon al Shem Sofo. I'm also going to take that strategy. It's why are we punishing him in the first place? It's about the place he's going to get through. But humans can't enact that. We're not supposed to stone him, right? Nidon al Shem Sofo created all sorts of, it addressed the disproportionate punishment, but it created all these other problems of like tshuva, can human courts really do that? The certainty. Once we get into this realm, he deals with the negative part of it and says, really, this was for God to decide. This isn't for us to mete out. And so either because you follow drosh v'kabel schar, or because you follow this is not for human execution, it's for divine, at the end of the day, we're not putting it into practice. And so that's how he deals with it. Okay, we're at time. I guess what I want to say in summary here, for how we should all deal with difficult texts, I want to say a couple of things.
Difficult son.
Yeah. I mean, what I love of what the rabbis are doing here, maybe with the exception of sitting on his grave, and we see this in the last text, is there even as the rabbis encounter a text that they find so difficult, they are so committed to the project of Torah that the wrestling they are doing is all within the framework of Torah, right? Even though it creates their positive, there are challenges and difficulties, but that they are going to deal with this difficult text within the framework of Midrash, right? Within the narrowing. And on one hand, there's an absurdity to the way they're doing it. Where are they pulling it from? Where are the proof texts? On the other hand, I think it shows such a deep commitment to Torah that even as they're dealing with their moral wrestlings, they're committed to doing it within the project project, Joshua Kabelskar, they're committed to doing within the project, right? This last answer of the actually was always about the heavenly courts. It's not about the human courts. And I think for me, that feels like the biggest, that's my biggest leaning of, you know, I think when we have those difficult courts, we have difficult texts, we have two options. You can cut them out and only learn the good stuff, or you can lean into the hard stuff and really wrestle with it. And my approach is those are the texts that we really have to lean into. And I think part of that leaning into is bringing our voices to the table sort of in a way that it's inclusive. And like, what does it look like for our eyes to lean into these texts and take them really seriously within the context of tradition and the bounds of that?
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.